There's a group of political appointees that are meeting that exclude career-level staff from the discussions.
An allegation the EPA withheld grants from Alaska after Senator Murkowski's health care vote. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the 425 deploys to Afghanistan.
Your training, your competence as combined arms teams uniquely qualify you to teach and mentor your Afghan partners in the art and science of war.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Army in Alaska is sending more than 2,000 troops to Afghanistan, and they've already started deploying.
So pick up your weapons and your snowshoes. Have fun, the soldiers are deployers from the last frontier.
At a ceremony at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson today, Colonel Mark Colebrook told soldiers and families the unit is well equipped to advise and assist military counterparts with the Afghan government for the 9-month mission.
Your training, your competence as combined arms teams, and the legal capabilities you can bring to bear uniquely qualify you to teach and mentor your Afghan partners in the art and science of war.
The 4th Brigade Combat Team's 25th Infantry Division, or 425, is sending 2,100 soldiers on the deployment. That's several hundred more people than was originally announced by the Army in April. News that the unit would be going overseas on its third deployment to the war in Afghanistan came alongside the decision by the Army not to cut the 425 size as part of a national reduction in the armed forces. Republican Senator Dan Sullivan fought against that cut and was on hand at the ceremony.
Of the 40,000 soldiers slated to be cut from the U.S. Army, only one unit was spared. One unit. This unit, the 425.
Sullivan told the crowd that a high number of President Trump's staff and advisors served or commanded in recent wars. And as a result, soldiers can expect an increasing amount of support during their deployment.
They've all deployed to Afghanistan. They know sacrifice and courage. They will ensure that you are resourced for this mission. In fact, in the briefing I just received, they emphasized that there will be much more close air support for you, and an emphasis on shutting down green-on-blue violence to protect you.
Green-on-blue is a reference to attacks by Afghan police and military members on U.S. forces. Some members of the 425 are already on the ground. The remainder of the unit's personnel will ship out in the weeks ahead, scattered mostly around the eastern part of Afghanistan. The Washington Post reported this week that the Environmental Protection Agency has started funneling all grant money through a single political appointee in the nation's capital. The Post also says EPA staff were told this summer to block all grants to Alaska. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin says the state has a lot riding on how EPA grants are awarded.
The Post says the order came in July, on the same day Senator Lisa Murkowski voted against a health care reform bill. At first, staffers were told to stop all grants to Region 10, the Northwest. Then the block was narrowed to just Alaska. The Post says it lasted 2 weeks. At the State Department of Environmental Conservation, Manager Bill Griffith is waiting for the state's annual water and sewer grants, about $40 million.
Those awards are made to the state late in the federal fiscal year, so that's typically sometime in September. We haven't received them yet, but that's not out of the ordinary.
The EPA sends about $30 million a year to Alaska tribes. And Griffith says he's heard tribal water and sewer grants haven't arrived yet either. Not by the first week in September, anyway. An EPA spokesman declined to answer any of the specific questions we asked about the new grant awards process. He didn't deny the Post's reporting, but replied to an email with a single sentence, saying the agency is making sure funding is in line with the EPA's mission and policy priorities. The Post names the ultimate decision maker on grants as John Conkus. He's a Deputy Associate Administrator of Public Affairs at EPA headquarters. Conkus was a county-level chairman for the Trump campaign in Florida. Some former EPA appointees say the new process doesn't sound good.
In my view, it's highly unusual. It's not something that I ever saw occur during the time that I was at EPA.
Dennis McLaren was the EPA Region 10 administrator under President Obama. In prior administrations, regional grant applications were decided at the regional level. And McLaren says it's the professional staffers in those offices who should be making the decisions because they have scientific and technical expertise.
The political screen is really, to my mind, not the appropriate way to go about looking at grant applications if you want people to believe that the judgments about who should receive the funding are fair and even-handed.
McLaren says every administration has its policy priorities. He says the way to carry them out is to put them in the criteria for making grant decisions, not by running all the applications through a political appointee. But McLaren says the Post report is in line with what he's heard about how the EPA is shifting under Administrator Scott Pruitt.
Certainly, I have heard from professional staff that remain at the agency that they're not being involved in decision-making as they used to be in prior administrations. There's a group of political appointees that are meeting that exclude career-level staff from the discussions.
The Washington Post reports that Conkus, the EPA appointee, doesn't like to see the words climate change on any applications. McLaren says that's not good for Alaska, where he says climate change is a top concern, especially in coastal villages. Kurt Ilo used to work for the EPA in Alaska. Now he runs a nonprofit in Anchorage that gets an EPA grant. Ilo says the Post article was alarming to Alaskans waiting for grant awards.
It adds more caution and more fear to our already nervous bunch of grantees in Alaska. But it, you know, we don't know what the outcome is going to be yet. So, but it certainly does increase the anxiety.
Ilo doesn't know of any Alaska grants that have been withheld, but he's concerned about the next funding cycle. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A 2-year-long investigation culminated today with the arrest of 24 Bethel residents, most of them cab drivers, for allegedly selling alcohol without a license. In other words, bootlegging. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur tells us more.
The state of Alaska is charging 18 cab drivers coming from all 4 Bethel taxi companies, plus the owner of one company and others accused of helping to illegally sell alcohol. Friday's charges follow a raid of the cab companies more than a year ago by the FBI, Bethel Police, and state troopers that uncovered tens of thousands of dollars in cash and a large number of liquor bottles. The undercover operation was conducted by the state troopers' Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team starting in December of 2015, before Bethel had legal packaged liquor stores. Court documents say investigators simply took cab rides and tried to make buys. The charges are misdemeanors, but the counts are multiple. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The uncle of 5 girls who died in a trailer fire in the Butte community near Palmer yesterday says they were all members of the same family. Armando Astorga identified the fire victims as 3-year-old Jaylin Flores, 6-year-old Sophia Flores, 7-year-old Liliana Flores, 8-year-old Nevaeh Flores, and 12-year-old Alexis Quakenbush. Astorga lives in Los Angeles and spoke by phone while in Seattle about to board a plane to Anchorage.
They were always together. They were always happy. You know, they were sisters, and I mean, they were a family. That's all they had was each other.
Astorga says his brother, the girl's father, had just started a new job as a school bus driver and was going through training early Thursday when his wife called. She had left them home alone for just a few minutes and returned to find their trailer ablaze. Astorga says the family had been trying to get their landlord to repair the trailer, including work on both a gas leak and an electrical issue. He says the landlord, who is a relatively new owner of the property, had been making the repairs. Astorga says his brother showed fire investigators the text messages between him and the landlord regarding the repairs. For now, Astorga says the family is still reeling from the horrible news that the five girls died. He says he hopes to help his brother and sister-in-law through the grieving process.
My brother lost all five of his babies. And in this way, it's unimaginable for a parent to go through.
For now, the fire remains under investigation. Neither the Alaska State Troopers nor the State Fire Marshal's Office have said publicly what they believe caused the fire. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, new evidence that Tlingit people occupied the area around Petersburg for thousands of years.
When we talk about ourselves, we say that we've been here since time immemorial.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ExxonMobil Alaska, whose goal is safe and responsible operations of the Point Thompson facility. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
Alaska Congressman Don Young reverted to form last night. He spoke harsh words about another lawmaker on the floor of the U.S. House. Judged against his past confrontations, this one was nothing spectacular. But then Young did do something unusual. He made nice. It happened during a late-night session in the House chamber. Young was pressing for an amendment to ditch an Obama administration rule limiting methods for killing bears and wolves in Alaska's national preserves. Washington State Democrat Pramila Jayapal argued for keeping the rule, something she said got under Young's skin. He suggested her statement came from the Humane Society.
And I really am disturbed. You may not know me, young lady. But I'm deeply disturbed. I am still talking.
His words. The gentleman has already impugned my motives by saying that I don't know a damn thing about what I'm talking about.
I didn't say he's damn, now you said
me,
it.
He's now called me young lady, and Mr. Chairman, I ask that he take down his words.
Gentlemen will suspend.
The proceedings were halted while intermediaries tried to make peace. After 5 minutes, Young relented.
I ask unanimous consent to withdraw my offending words. And to the lady, I do apologize. I get very defensive about my state.
And then Young's amendment passed, 215 to 196. The bill is likely to clear the House next week. Yesterday in Anchorage, Governor Bill Walker gave a wide-ranging speech to the Resource Development Council, an industry group. Walker addressed the status of the Alaska LNG mega project, a state-led plan to build an 800-mile pipeline to carry natural gas from the North Slope. Over the last year, the state has focused on finding buyers. Although no firm commitments have been announced, Walker said he's encouraged by conversations he's had with leaders of potential markets like China and South Korea. But the governor also said he's not likely to ask the legislature for more money for the project once current funding dries up.
I don't allow myself to get optimistic anymore. I'm hopeful, and I am hopeful. But can we continue on after this funding? I'm doubtful, quite honestly.
The state currently has about $100 million to pursue the gas line. That money is supposed to last through the next fiscal year. More information is coming to light about the failure of a fish farm operation in Puget Sound that led to the escape of thousands of Atlantic salmon. Washington state officials knew at least 6 months ago that the salmon farm that collapsed last month was on its last legs. Corrosion and metal fatigue had weakened the floating steel structure. Even so, the state agreed to let the fish farm grow a full load of 3 million pounds of Atlantic salmon in an area swept by strong currents. John Ryan from KUOW in Seattle brings us the story.
The revelations about accelerating corrosion and metal fatigue come from a company proposal to replace its aging fish farm off Cypress Island. Cook Aquaculture's permit application from February says the floating steel pens were near the end of their serviceable life. It explains that the constant effects of salt water, wave energy, and tidal currents had taken their toll on the 16-year-old farm.
The system was ready to be replaced.
Chuck Brown is a spokesperson for Cook Aquaculture. The Canadian company has fish farms on three continents.
Unfortunately, we didn't get the work done before this incident occurred.
This incident was a maritime industrial disaster. More than 160,000 Atlantic salmon made a jailbreak. They've been swimming throughout Puget Sound and beyond. Some of them have gotten as far as the outer coast of Vancouver Island. That's 150 miles away. One bit of good news for wild salmon. So far, the 10-pound predators from another part of the planet don't appear to be eating anything. Their stomachs have been empty when they're caught. But why did this disaster happen? Officials blamed it on big tides and currents. But the currents that pushed the fish farm off its anchors in July and destroyed it a month later weren't exceptional. What was different was all the extra weight the fish farm had put on. By August, the 300,000 fast-growing salmon were nearly ready for market. At least seven different agencies have a finger in regulating salmon farms in Washington.
You need permission from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard, the Food and Drug Administration, the Washington Department of Fish and
Wildlife. Joe Smiley is a spokesperson for the Washington Department of Natural Resources.
Everybody's looking at these facilities as they're permitted and moved and upgraded.
Yet nobody kept Cook Aquaculture from filling its damaged fish farm up to the gills.
I'm just wondering, given that the state learned about corrosion and other structural problems there, was it prudent to let it be loaded to that full 3.1 million pounds?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we're investigating with our sister agencies right now.
DNR had inspected the Cypress Island farm last September, and it heard about the company's plan to replace the farm with a new, stronger one. But the DNR inspector wasn't looking for structural damage.
You know, it's one of those things, we don't have a whole lot of structural engineers on staff to go out and inspect our lease facilities.
DNR has told the company it expects structural inspections of its seven remaining fish farms as soon as the big Atlantic salmon spill is under control. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan.
Tomorrow, NOAA Fisheries Alaska is organizing its first ever citizen beluga count in Cook Inlet, and you're invited. There will be a dozen viewing spots along Kinnick and Turnagain Arms. Each will have NOAA staff or volunteers with binoculars and spotting scopes for the public to use. Julie Spiegel of NOAA's Juneau headquarters is in Anchorage coordinating the event.
It's part of our recovery plan. One of the actions in our recovery plan is to have a citizen science count day for beluga whales. And so this is one of those actions that we're doing to bring public awareness to the endangered Cook Inlet beluga whales and efforts to recover them.
Before collapsing in the mid-1990s, there were upwards of 1,300 belugas in Cook Inlet. Based on the most recent survey conducted in 2016, there are an estimated 328 left. The beluga count on Saturday morning is only part of what Spiegel called a beluga festival, with activities at the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, a thousand-year-old fish pile. The small island town of Petersburg in southeast Alaska is known for its Norwegian heritage, and it's celebrated by the community throughout the year. The current town site was established around 1900 by Norwegians looking for a good spot to process fish commercially. But as Angela Denning reports, archaeologists are finding more evidence that Mitkoff Island is just like others in the region, Tlingit people had settlements around Petersburg for thousands of years before Europeans planted their roots.
Along Petersburg's main downtown street, Ross Nanek III is selling his artwork from a table on the sidewalk. His hair is pulled back in a ponytail under a leather hat that's painted with Tlingit design in red, black, and turquoise.
As this.
What do you carve with?
Right now I'm using these to carve.
Nanek enjoys talking about his carvings and paintings. He's sort of a culture bearer, teaching about Tlingit artwork and history to Petersburg tourists and students.
I am Suktin Adi of Kekhkwan, and I come from the Tlingit.
Although Nanek knows his Tlingit name, he was never taught the language. His grandparents' generation didn't pass it on.
Assimilation has taken a big toll on our culture, and for over 100 years we were told to forget our ways. We were told that our totem poles and our carvings were works of the devil and we should burn them. There's a disconnect of just who we are.
Still, artifacts are everywhere on Mitkof Island, showing a long history of indigenous people.
Hi. Hey, come on up.
Jane Smith and Gina Esposito are archaeologists for the U.S. Forest Service in Petersburg, and it's their job to keep track of artifacts found in the area. Their offices are on the second floor of a downtown building, and it's just what you'd think it'd look like. Maps on the walls, shelves of rocks and bags of soil samples, a yellow hard hat on a backpack on the floor.
As you can see, we could use more space.
Organized chaos.
Yeah. That's what we have here.
We have soil probes here,
Soil probes.
Soil augers that help us find shell-midden sites.
Shell-midden sites are like prehistoric trash piles. Esposito says that Tlingit ancestors left mounds of shellfish remains, charcoal, and fish bones.
After they would harvest and eat and process, they would just toss it out outside their homes or outside their campsites or at their villages. And then over time, that builds up.
The rainforest grows over the piles, so the soil probes are used to find them. These sites indicate where people were living for long periods of time. And that's what Esposito and her colleague recently discovered less than a mile from Petersburg.
Right across from town, we've found evidence that there's village-sized sites across the Narrows.
The site was dated to 1,120 years ago. On Mitkof Island itself, they've discovered a 5,000-year-old fish trap. In fact, large-scale fish traps of various ages have been documented in all major waterways on the island. Smith and Esposito have worked together as an archaeology team for 20 years. Their oldest discovery near Petersburg is a 10,000-year-old site containing stone tool remnants. It was also found on Kuprinov Island near Petersburg. The pair tracks over 900 archaeology sites, including several rock paintings and carvings. Smith says they keep fastidious notes on the materials they collect and the GPS coordinates of the sites.
And one of the reasons that we want to know where they are is so when the Forest Service does an action, like builds a road or puts in an outhouse or whatever they're going to be doing that might be a ground-disturbing activity, we know where the archaeology sites are so we can avoid them.
Smith and Esposito work with Petersburg Indian Association, the local tribe, to try to connect what they've found in the field to traditional knowledge. The locations of the sites are not shared with the general public for fear of vandalism. But the story that's been perpetuated publicly is a different one. Published articles and websites say that Mitkof Island was never inhabited permanently by native people. It was an occasional stopover for fishermen and hunters for the past few thousand years. But that's not the entire story.
It's, it's kind of emotional, really.
Brenda Norheim is a board member for the local tribe. Like other Petersburg residents, she's grown up being told that no one was living around Petersburg when white settlers arrived. But that left a hole to her past. Where were her people? She didn't learn the answers at home. When her mother was growing up in Petersburg, there were signs that read, "No natives." She wasn't told traditional stories or taught the Tlingit language by her elders.
Natives weren't allowed to buy land. So, were they just not here because somebody said they weren't here?
Some of these questions might never get answered. What Norheim hopes for now is that the archaeology finds bring a shared history to town. One of indigenous natives and Norwegian settlers. Back on Petersburg's main street, Nanek watches the cars go by and says he's not surprised by what the archaeologists have been finding.
When we talk about ourselves, we say that we've been here since time immemorial.
He says the science just adds to what he already knows, that his people have been living on and around Mitkof Island for a very, very long time. For AK, I'm Angela Denning.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. Today we're hearing from Carlos Godfrey of McGrath. Godfrey works for the National Weather Service and is based in Anchorage.
They call us the MOBU. It's the Mobile Emergency Unit. So our job is to go out and keep the station running smoothly. We replace people that go on vacation, people that quit, retire, whatever. And my job is work with them, and then when they get a new employee, train them on, get them on station, then I leave. My first station was Bethel, Alaska. That's where I got hired on to, and I came there in 1996. And I worked there for 5 years. My next location was actually McGrath. Yeah, I went to King Sam, Alaska, and then I was there for probably, I don't know, maybe 6 months. And then I went to Cold Bay. And I worked in Cold Bay, I think that was for about 9 months. And then from there, I went to St. Paul. It kind of reminded me a little bit where I grew up, because I didn't grow up in the city part of Georgia. You know, you would go to town once a month, so it wasn't nothing big change for me. I've been welcome in every community I've been to. Like I said, I got friends everywhere. They always constantly telling me to come back, and you know, when you coming back? Like even McGrath, I was just in Cold Bay, and they was all, you know, when you coming back to McGrath? You know, you need to come back out here. You haven't been there a while. I love them all. You know, I go to every station. I know a lot of people, you know, I'm happy when I get here, but then it's kind of a little saddening when you gotta leave. But you know, I know I'm going to another community, so I kind of get over pretty fast. It doesn't come such a part of me to travel around and to see everybody that I think it'll be hard to walk away from, but I'm sure at some point I will make that decision that, okay, I traveled out, it's time to let it go. But right now I haven't reached that point yet.
Carlos Godfrey lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Angela Denning, Sam Davenport, and Ann Hillman. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Casey Grove, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Jay Barrett in Kenai, and John Ryan in Seattle. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.